Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects, and the news will begin in a moment and talk about the state of U.S. diplomacy. We'll be speaking with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who's a former United States ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He's also been the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies and the Director of Chinese Affairs at the State Department, among other positions. Ambassador Freeman is currently the Chairman of Projects International Incorporated and the President of the Middle East Policy Council and co-chair of the U.S.-China Policy Council and vice chair of the Atlantic Council. So I'll be talking to Ambassador Chaz Freeman in a moment. And then we'll talk with Thomas Ricks, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and the Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent. He also covered the Pentagon for the Wall Street Journal prior to that, and he has a new book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, which has been described as the definitive military chronicle of the Iraq War and a searing judgment of the strategic blindness with which America has conducted it, drawing on the accounts of senior military officers giving voice to their anger for the first time. And, of course, just this week in the Senate, before the Senate both Generals Abizaid and Pace, along with the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, the two generals suggested for the first time that a civil war may well be happening, at least not quite yet, but it wasn't, in a sense, a repudiation of the man sitting next to them, the architect of the war, the Secretary of Defense. So we'll be talking to Thomas Ricks in the context of what's happening in Iraq. I'm now speaking with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who's as I mentioned, the former United States Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He's also been the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies and the Director of Chinese Affairs for the State Department, among other positions. He is a member of the American Academy of Diplomacy. He is a recipient of many honors, including the Department of Defense Meritorious Service, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, the CIA Medallion, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, the Distinguished Honor Award, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and the Presidential Meritorious Service Award. Ambassador Freeman is currently the Chairman of Projects International Incorporated and the President of the Middle East Policy Council and also the co-chair of the U.S.-China Policy Council and vice chair of the Atlantic Council. And Ambassador Chaz Freeman, you have described the Bush foreign policy as diplomacy-free foreign policy and compassionate colonialism. At this point, with a massive demonstration over the weekend in Sadr City in Iraq in favor of Hezbollah, who were at war with Israel, and with the testimony of the two generals, both the chairman and the general in charge of Iraq, General Abizaid, rather sobering testimony, to say the least. At this point, it's hard to look at American foreign policy and not see it as being not so much in, you know, perhaps poised for great disaster, I would say.
Well, I think it's clear that Israel has made a series of truly historic military blunders, which have been compounded by our decision to egg Israel on and then to back it diplomatically. And you're correct to mention Iraq in that context because, of course, even as the Israeli onslaught in Lebanon has made Hezbollah the dominant political party in Lebanon and United Lebanese behind it, a complete reversal of the divisions and distaste for Hezbollah that prevailed a month ago. It has also brought to the fore the fact that the Shiite tyranny of the majority, which we have been working to install in Iraq, is in very close sympathy with Hezbollah and not at all supportive of us. And we are putting huge strain on what used to be called the Arab Street in Iraq, and as we know, that can have consequences. Al-Qaeda didn't come from Al-Qaedistan. It came from the Arab Street. And the danger is that Iraqi Shiites may well, for their own reasons, having to do with solidarity with Hezbollah, turn on us, even as Sunni Arab Iraqis have done.
Well, given our tenuous situation in Iraq, it's impossible to believe that the White House welcomed this Israeli response to the kidnapping of two of their soldiers. Was the White House blindsided?
I suspect they were, but I have to say that the Israeli response, which was purely military and more emotional, I think, than carefully calculated, was one that was very resonant with the foreign policy we've been following for the last 5 or 6 years, where we seem to believe that there's no problem that doesn't have a military solution, despite all the evidence that's mounting to show that is a very dubious, not to say erroneous, proposition. So I think the White House fell behind Israel with some enthusiasm, but probably didn't know anything about this in advance.
Well, why do you think then that, I mean, I guess there's a genesis here to President Bush's breaking with tradition vis-a-vis Israel. That it was first revealed in when the Secretary of the Treasury first was sort of eased out of the White House and wrote a book about, I think, the first meeting in the National Security Council where President Bush basically said, you know, forget about the Palestinians, we're throwing our lot in with Israel. And I believe when he was governor of Texas, I think the only foreign trip he had taken in his life, he went to Israel and to visit his daughter in Rome. And it was Ariel Sharon under protocol who took him on a helicopter trip around Israel. And of course, it's worth noting that he apparently did try to get a meeting with Arafat, but Arafat didn't think he was worth meeting with. Another example of what Abu Iban once said, Arafat never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But the long and the short of it is that, do you detect a difference here, and do you think the president has some kind of an emotional connection with the Israelis?
I think that his political strategy has rested heavily on, if not taking Jewish American support away from, if not gaining Jewish American support for the Republican Party, taking it away from Democrats, and that a good deal of this is driven by domestic political calculations, and therefore belongs more to the sphere of Karl Rove than it does to the sphere of Condi Rice. Yes, I think there has been an almost total identification of the United States with Israel, the abandonment of any effort to maintain other friendships on a continuing basis in the Middle East. And in this sense, the most stupid partisans of Israel in the United States have achieved their objective of ensuring that the United States has only one friend in the Middle East, namely Israel. And the proof of that has come during this crisis where our Secretary of State was basically disinvited from every Arab capital, including Beirut. And we are not able, apparently, to communicate with those who are key to solving Israel's problem. I think much to the distress of Israelis. So the degree of American identification with Israel has come around to be a problem, not just for us, but for Israel as well. And it is impeding some more advantageous solution to this than seems likely to occur.
Well, isn't there a broader explanation in the sense that that Israel has had extraordinary influence in Washington, particularly in the Congress, and in politics, the race goes to the swiftest, and they seem to have the best organized lobby. And in effect, you could argue that when you are such an effective lobby, you end up talking to yourself, and that's perhaps why they can't get off the dime.
Well, I think there is a general point there that I quite agree with, which is that if you don't have debate and discussion, and if you entrust all policymaking to a monopoly point of view, whatever it is, you end up getting pretty bad policy. And that, of course, is very much what happened in the wake of 9/11 with the lurch into Iraq, which frankly wasn't debated at all in the Congress, and only feebly in the press. So we, in the case of matters having to do with Israel, American public opinion is solidly behind Israel, and anyone who questions what Israel does is immediately subjected to derogatory comment and discredited as anti-Semitic. Well, it's quite possible to think that Israel's not all wise and that it makes mistakes and not be at all anti-Semitic. So I think in the end we pay a price for the sort of groupthink and political correctness and resulting absence of debate that has characterized that issue.
But you could also argue, Ambassador Chaz Friedman, that this situation requires adult intervention. It's almost like two drunks on a street lashing out at each other with broken beer bottles. Instead, we seem to be having abandoned the Israeli-Palestinian efforts, which Clinton was pushing right up to the end. We've sort of let them sort of duke it out, it seems. And I can't see what possible benefit there's been to this so-called shuttle diplomacy of Condoleezza Rice's, where she's essentially negotiating with the French, not with the Lebanese.
Well, she actually wasn't able to do shuttle diplomacy because, as I said, with the exception of one visit to Lebanon, where there was no real meeting of the minds, she's not been able to go to any capital other than Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, as the case might be, namely in Israel. And so we have basically emasculated ourselves diplomatically in the Middle East. We no longer have any significant ability to help. And as I say, that's too bad, because at root there is a set of intertwined problems that Israel's been trying with remarkable lack of success to deal with for 59 years, in which, if resolved, or which require to be resolved to give Israel the security that we all want to see for it. The United States basically has succeeded in marginalizing ourselves, and we're no longer able to play the useful role we once did. And that is a matter of choice. There was no reason that we had to behave that way, or to collude in the Israeli tactic of always finding that there's nobody to talk to on the Palestinian side. There was no point in talking to Arafat, we were told. There's no point in talking to Mahmoud Abbas, apparently, and we certainly wouldn't want to talk to the elected authorities among the Palestinians, even though clearly they have the legitimacy among Palestinians to deliver on a deal. Similarly, now we're not able to talk to the powers that be in Lebanon or those outside Lebanon who aid and abet them in Syria and Iran. So we've managed to make ourselves diplomatically quite irrelevant and reduced our role to that of quartermaster for a very misguided military effort on the part of Israel.
But you could broaden that out, Ambassador Chaz Friedman, to the extent to which the axis of evil was pronounced some time ago by the Bush administration, and it seems that we are effectively prosecuting a foreign policy of name-calling, where we don't talk to the bad guys. And one of the more appalling examples of that was that shortly after the so-called victory in Iraq of April the 10th, when the statue of Saddam came down, apparently the Iranian government, through intermediaries, approached the White House, and they were quite alarmed. They thought that they'd be next, and they basically told the White House, look, anything and everything's on the table. We have authority from the Supreme Leader to discuss with you. And that was a point where the United States actually had some leverage over the mullahs. And apparently Vice President Cheney said, we don't talk to evil. And now, of course, if you look at Iraq and you look at Lebanon, it looks like evil has won.
Well, I think Rich Armitage, who was Deputy Secretary of State in the first Bush term, was correct when he said that problem-solving and diplomacy has to involve talking to adversaries and not just to a frankly narrowing circle of friends. It's the adversaries who hold the keys to solving issues, and it's they whom you must either deter or persuade to do what you want them to do. I think in the case of the Middle East, there's no more egregious example, really, than the one you've cited, which is Iran. And I would summarize our policy there as consisting of the following elements. One, you're evil. Two, we won't speak with you unless, of course, you capitulate to all our demands before we open a dialogue. Three, we intend to overthrow your regime and are actually appropriating money and working with exile groups to that end. Four, if you try to deter us somehow or develop an effective deterrent against us in the military sphere, we will very likely bomb you, possibly with nuclear weapons. And five, if you don't respond to the course of diplomacy I've just outlined, we will certainly bomb you, possibly with nuclear weapons. I would suggest this is not diplomacy, but a series of blustery threats, and which in the end are probably unimplementable. It's not a recipe for success, and it's no surprise that it hasn't achieved it.
But Iran has been immensely rewarded by our misadventure in Iraq. The intervention in Iraq has basically turned over the power to the Shiites, who all Shiite parties are deeply connected to Iran, and Muqtada al-Sadr is supposedly run by the Revolutionary Guards, and Dawa resided in Iran, and the Badr Army was trained there, and the Supreme Council, Sistani, the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah, is in fact an Iranian. So, one, it seems that this neoconservative misadventure has actually strengthened Iran, even though the neocons apparently have Iran in their crosshairs. That's the next target, as it were. And then prior to our intervention in Iraq, it's worth noting that the Iranian opposition seemed to have the mullahs on the ropes, but now they have been completely undercut, and our policy has essentially driven the Iranian opposition into the embrace of the mullahs, and nobody in Iran wants to be liberated by the United States if Iraq is an example.
I think the result of Iraq is widely seen in the region as primarily of benefit to Iran, and there has been widespread concern, particularly among Arabs in the Gulf and in Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, in particular about the emergence of an Iranian-influenced Shiite bloc or crescent. And one can see the outlines of that now with Hezbollah attracting strong support from the Shiite regime in Baghdad, as well as from Tehran, and of course receiving continued facilitation from the Syrians, even though they don't really like Hezbollah ideologically. They find it convenient to partner with them. So we have now a very clear Iranian domination of quite a swath of the northern part of the Middle East, and this is indeed an ironic result of the what you correctly call misadventure in Iraq.
So since you have the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis, actually the foreign minister some time back, came out and suggested that the United States had in fact strengthened Iran, and if indeed the generals who were, they didn't say that there was a civil war, but they suggested one we're on the cusp of it, and that of course has been said for some time. But if there is a full-blown civil war in Iraq, it's hard to imagine that it won't turn into a regional war, and to some extent you could argue that already it's a surrogate war, given that the Shia are supported by Iran and the Sunni by Jordan, the Gulf, and Saudi Arabia. So it seems to me that there's another shoe that could drop here that's actually quite catastrophic.
Well, I think it's been clear to those who follow Iraq closely for quite some time that there have been several civil wars going on there, land grabs going on between Kurds and Arabs, with Kurds taking, or they would argue perhaps repossessing, lands from Arabs at the point of a gun. There is a struggle between the disempowered Sunni minority of Arabs and the now suddenly empowered Shiite majority of Arabs. And there are warlords and factions within the Shiites who have been fighting each other and who may yet do so. So there have been many struggles going on. I think the concern in the region expressed by Prince Saud and most clearly is twofold in this context. One is that Iraq has all the potential to become a 21st century version of the Spanish Civil War, in which Iraqis, in the course of fighting each other, draw on support from outside and take the essentially low-intensity conflict they've been conducting and elevate it, particularly if there were a precipitate American withdrawal, to the level of conventional warfare, dragging everyone in the region and perhaps beyond it into a proxy battle and some sort of rehearsal for a wider conflict. Or alternatively, Iraq, in the eyes of Sunni Arabs, may be the cockpit in which some Arab or Islamic version of the 30 Years' War in Central Europe is being brewed up, in which, in that case, of course, Protestants and Catholics, having lived uncomfortably side by side for some time, rose up and began murdering each other by the millions. And this Iraqi Shiite-Sunni struggle has the capacity to ignite a wider conflict within the realm of Islam, which would be deeply destabilizing as far away as Southeast Asia and throughout Africa, as well as in the Middle East itself. So I think there is a great deal of concern that the United States still hasn't quite figured out what we're doing in Iraq and inadvertently maybe creating even bigger problems than have already become apparent.
Well, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, apparently, he said that a couple of months before the United States went into Iraq, senior Iraqi exiles were meeting with the president, and he apparently didn't know the difference between Sunni and Shia.
That's hardly uncommon. I suspect most Sunnis and Shias don't know the difference between Lutherans and Catholics.
Well, but just to quote Ambassador Galbraith again, he wrote a piece in the New York Times recently suggesting that perhaps our only option in Iraq in terms of an exit strategy is to retreat into the Kurdish north. And if things go to hell in a handbasket, it's pretty clear that the Shia will actually block the American escape route to Kuwait, because the lines there would be cut immediately. And it's been argued that the British army down in Basra is essentially hostage, and with one phone call, the whole thing could go to hell. So what's your sense of whether, you know, if things head the way that they seem to be inexorably heading, what are our options?
I don't think there's a Kurdish option. You can't get to Kurdistan except across either Iraq or Syria or Turkey, and the Turks have no interest in seeing us buttress an independent Kurdish state, which is essentially what Peter's suggestion would do. Nor do the Iranians, nor do the Syrians, and certainly the Iraqi Arabs do not. So I think that is a retreat into a hole within from which there's no easy escape, and a very bad idea, although I understand Peter's affection for the Kurds. I don't think that is going to serve their interests or ours. What are our options at this point? They are quite narrow. We have created an enormous mess. I don't think we can simply walk away from it and pretend that we didn't create it. In many ways, we are, however, doing that. We have ceased to request funding for the reconstruction of Iraq, and clearly we have not accomplished that objective. We are obviously looking for a way to draw down and leave, but we have never clarified the question of whether we intend to maintain long-term bases there. We are not dealing with Iraq's neighbors, so we can't enlist their support in stabilizing Iraq. In fact, the whole adventure in Iraq is a very nice illustration of one fact, namely you can't have stability in Iraq and simultaneously try to destabilize Syria and Iran. Either you deal with Syria and Iran as they are, or you have an unstable Iraq. So there's no easy answer at this point, and the fear among the Sunni Arab neighbors of Iraq is that the United States, to quote one leader with whom I spoke not so long ago, having trashed Iraq and set it on fire, will now leave, allowing the neighbors to die of smoke inhalation.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, is it possible that there is some Machiavellian plan here that we're missing? I mean, the neocons who were the architects of this war and who have enormous traction within the DOD and within the Vice President's office, and I'm sure being a veteran in Washington, they've been around for a long time, and they had some traction during the Reagan period, and but none in Bush seniors and none in Clinton's. But there's no question that there was a plan that was drawn up actually at the behest of Prime Minister Netanyahu. But it seems to me that the whole thing has been a catastrophe and a monstrous blunder. I don't see this Machiavellian sort of silver lining, if you will, that the whole purpose of this was to, in effect, to create creative destruction. In other words, to set the Shia and the Sunni at each other and to create, as you suggested, a mirror of the 30 years war in Europe. So do you think, just in closing, that these people are criminally incompetent, or are they, Machiavellian?
Well, let's remember what they set out to do. Their purpose was to cement American hegemony or dominance and to ensure that no one could challenge us internationally and to, in the Middle East, create a new paradigm which would favor Israeli dominance in partnership with the United States. I think on both grounds, the results have been totally counterproductive. The United States has never been so isolated internationally. Our leadership has never been so questioned internationally. And Israel has seldom been as insecure as it is at present. Nor have we cemented a position in the Middle East. The effort to abandon our friendship with Saudi Arabia on the basis that the Saudis afforded us for our conduct of military operations and substitute Iraq has proven to be a disastrous failure. And some of the wilder dreams that went into this, the sort of notion that you could do hit-and-run democratization of the Middle East somehow on the cheap, have proven to be farcical. I'm far from seeing any Machiavellian scheme. I see a level of incompetence that is simply awe-inspiring.
And just in closing then, what do you think is going to happen vis-a-vis, I mean, it seems that the impetuous and immature use of force has in fact undermined American power, and it's beginning to look that in the same way that these neophyte leaders in Israel, it's almost like you wish for a Sharon or a Barak or a Rabin, or somebody that was a general, that these guys that had little military experience seem to have been rolled by the military, and the chief of staff of the Israeli military is an Air Force general, and I think he promised that they'd win by bombing, and it doesn't. In other words, I'm seeing a mirror here between our blunders in Iraq and their blunders in Lebanon.
I think philosophically we've been on much the same wavelength, and the notion that somehow might can make right, or that you can flog people into docility, or that holding a gun to someone will cause someone's head will cause them to wish to cooperate with you out of anything but temporary expediency, rather than make them your enemy in the long term, have all been disproven by on multiple occasions. I think the relevance of this is that Einstein defined madness as doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result, and by that definition, we're mad, both our current leadership and the Israelis. The final note, I think you're absolutely correct to point to military inexperience as a key element here. Our military and the Israeli military are a great deal more understanding of the limitations of the use of force and what it can't accomplish than the bloodthirsty civilians who've been directing them. To my experience, the military are always much more inclined to try measures short of war before resorting to force, not simply because they're the ones who have to die and are, as in the case of Iraq, left holding the bag when the civilians make a terrible error of judgment, but also because they understand very well that force has its limitations, that there are many problems which are not amenable to resolution by the use of force, and that sometimes war, as in the case of Israel's war in Lebanon at present, in a strange inversion of Clausewitz, is the continuation of policy failure by other means.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ambassador Chas Freeman.
My pleasure, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ambassador Chas Freeman, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He's also been the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies, the Director of Chinese Affairs at the Department of State, among other positions. And now Ambassador Freeman is Chairman of Projects International and the President of the Middle East Policy Council and Co-Chair of the U.S.-China Policy Council and Vice Chair of the Atlantic Council. I'm now speaking to Thomas Ricks, who's a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the Washington Post. He's their senior Pentagon correspondent, where he's covered the U.S. military since 2000. And until the end of 1999, he held the same beat at the Wall Street Journal, where he was a reporter for 17 years. His new book is Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, which has been described as the definitive military chronicle of the Iraq War, and a searing judgment on the strategic blindness with which America has conducted it, drawing on accounts of senior military officers giving voice to their anger for the first time. And Thomas Ricks, I would say that Peter Pace and General Abizaid sitting there this week in the Senate being grilled by the, Hillary Clinton and others were, and with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld sitting beside them, they weren't so much giving voice to their anger, but you could feel the frustration and feel the extent to which they're caught trying to be honest at the same time delivering bad news.
Well, I think that they were picking up the strong vibe from Congress that congressional patience is running out, even on the Republican side. Also, I think the Democrats are beginning to find a voice. The Democrats were terrified of getting on the wrong side of this war, because so many of them felt burned by getting on the wrong side of the 91 war. But now I think they're picking up in their visits to home that the American people are genuinely frustrated and upset with the course of the war and aren't going to put up with sort of more stay-the-course rhetoric.
And what do you think the American people learned from this extraordinary demonstration this weekend inside a city where the organizers of the demonstration, largely Muqtada al-Sadr, suggested there are up to 3 million people demonstrating, and the Pentagon said there was 15,000.
I keep on thinking of a song by a young good news singer named Josh Ritter. He has a song in his new album about the war in Iraq, and the refrain asked a question, what is it that we've done? And I think that's about where the American people are asking, what is it we've done? And that demonstration you point to is a wonderful example of that. Here we are supporting the Israeli attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon. Yet in Iran, we have transferred power massively from the Sunnis to the Shiites. And probably the major recipient of power at this point is Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric. and he got out somewhere between 50,000, 100,000, 200,000, nobody seems to know what the numbers were, of people supporting Hezbollah. So here, the guy we've empowered in Iraq, the country that was supposed to be our transformation of begin our transformation of the Middle East, is a major Hezbollah supporter. So you kind of scratch your head and say, what exactly we've done here?
Well, Muqtada al-Sadr himself, though, of course, was at one point he was wanted dead or alive. The head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, Bremer, basically put out a hit on him, closed down his newspaper, and then he took on the U.S. military, and a lot of our boys and girls died, including the son of the anti-war activist Sidney Sheehan, and he's gotten off scot-free.
And here he is, yes, a major figure in the new government that we keep on citing as the wonderful result of elections. Muqtada al-Sadr, you're right. The United States government said that they were going to capture or kill him, and instead he's in the new government, and a lot of American troops who his troops confronted in the spring of 2004 are still dead.
So I know your book Fiasco talks about that, but can you just run us through what was Bremer thinking? Or why didn't they do the job? I mean, what's wrong with them? If you put out a hit on somebody, you either do it or you can't be surprised when he comes back at you.
Yeah, that's right. This is sort of, you know, fundamental lesson of the Godfather movies. You know, don't threaten somebody unless you mean it. And the Marines know this, especially in Marine boot camp. You're taught never point your weapon at somebody unless you're willing to pull the trigger. But I think Bremer's problem is a fundamental strategic problem we've had in Iraq, is we've never really been clear about what we're trying to do there. We've never had a clear command structure. Bremer was at odds with the U.S. military about whether to go after Sadr, but there has never been one person in charge of the U.S. effort in Iraq, and that's one of the major rules of counterinsurgency. We violated many of them, but that one of them is always have one person in charge, have unity of command, and to make it a civilian, because ultimately the solution has to be political, not military. But we've always had a divided command structure in Iraq where the civilians and the military have separate chains of command. Nobody runs the whole effort, and they report back to people here on the other side of the planet who also are trying to do other things.
And in terms of your book, Thomas Rex Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, you've obviously spoken to an awful lot of people inside the military, and you have, a couple of decades of experience inside the Pentagon. So, an old friend of mine, Colonel Hackworth, who's one of America's most decorated soldiers, unfortunately has passed on, but he always talked about this. They're the ticket punchers and the true warriors. And it seems to me that it looks like the ticket punchers had most of the say, because you point out that some of them, particularly the more enlightened people like the special forces people, knew how to conduct this. Not so much the war. I mean, who could have thought that the United States would not defeat Iraq, having defeated them once before? So it's astounding to me that the whole country went mad back in that period when we had Operation Desert, what was it called, Operation Iraqi Freedom. We weren't going to have a military victory. So it seems to me the whole thing was always about what do you do with the country.
And a lot of people agreed with you. The problem was that I think you had probably the worst war plan in American history, designed by General Tommy Franks and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld together. And you put your finger on the problem with it, which was that it focused all its energies and attention on the 10% problem, getting to Baghdad, and it neglected terribly the 90% problem, what do you do once you get there? And on top of that, I think a little bit contrary to what Ambassador Freeman was just saying, the U.S. military also played a big role in bungling Iraq. I would say the preponderance of blame up to the time of the invasion has to rest on the shoulders of the Bush administration for the way in which it went to war. But since the fall of Baghdad, I would say that much of the blame, even most of the blame, should be put on the shoulders of U.S. military leadership, the uniformed military, that went into Iraq professionally unprepared to deal with an insurgency, that hadn't been trained by the military, by its own leadership, to confront this sort of problem, to understand it, and they put troops into situations for which they were terribly unprepared, not just in terms of equipment, but even more importantly, conceptually. One thing that struck me looking at troops in the summer of 2003 was how they tried to deter looters. The 1st Armored Division was a pretty good unit in Iraq, but some of its soldiers decided that the best way to deter looters was to make them cry. And so some soldiers in the 1st Armored Division one day captured a father and his two teenage sons out looting. And they said to the father, "Which of your sons do you want us to shoot?" And the father said, as most would, "Don't shoot them, please shoot me instead." They said, "You don't get to make that choice," and they took one of the sons around to the other side of a truck where he couldn't be seen, and they fired a weapon past his head. Then the three Iraqis were released as they were crying. That's not a way to win over the people, which is the prize in insurgency. The American military tend to look at the people as the playing field, as something that got in the way, when people really, the Iraqi people, really were the heart of the struggle. They were what you wanted to have on your side. And we use tactics like that and policies from Bremer that really alienated the broad middle of the Iraqi population.
Well, but just on your point, Thomas Ricks, about the looting, it seems to me that General Shinseki, the chief staff of the army, said that we needed at least a quarter of a million, perhaps 300,000 soldiers, and we went in with we basically always had around 150,000. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that a couple of days after the so-called victory, when the looting began, to the average Iraqi, the new guys in town, the superpower, couldn't provide security. And you're not going to win over a population who have been lobotomized and terrorized by fear. There was no accident that they called Iraq the Republic of Fear. So if they're afraid that the bad guys, and if you fraternize with the Americans, the bad guys are going to come back in the middle of the night and kill you. We were never to gave them the assurances that they were secure.
That's right. The looting was a terrible message to send, and it really, I think, had much more impact in Iraq than people back here understood. It sent the message that the Americans either couldn't stop the looting, which was a pretty scary message, or didn't want to stop the looting, which was an even scarier message.
Right. They only protected the oil ministry.
That's right. And when the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, was dismissive of it, saying, you know, stuff happens, I think that was a chilling message to send to Iraq, which is the Americans aren't really paying attention here or don't care. They don't mind if we descend into chaos. And I think that caused broad resentment among the Iraqi middle class. We keep on talking about Iraq being a democracy, at least the U.S. government does, because it's had elections. Democracy is more than elections. Democracy is security, as you say. It's the rule of law. It's the belief that the policeman on the corner will enforce the law rather than being part of a death squad. It's also having a broad middle class. But instead, the middle class in Iraq right now is fleeing. It's the doctors, the lawyers, the professors, the journalists who are getting out of the country if they can. And they're all heading off to Jordan or to Syria or the Gulf States or England or here. What you're left with is the democracy of the gun. And basically, you have armed militias slugging it out for control in Iraq right now, and the U.S. military becoming increasingly irrelevant.
Well, we're almost spectators at our own disaster.
Yeah.
But tell me, though, why it is that within the military, the kind of the quality or the lack of quality of leadership that led to Abu Ghraib and these abuses and these massacres was able to transcend the sage advice of some of the special forces people who wanted to help the Iraqi people, and they felt that that was the whole purpose of the so-called liberation. I mean, you don't liberate people by killing them, after all.
Well, I think we had a hubristic military. It thought of itself as winners. And that's a real contrast to the military of 1991 in the Gulf War. They had known the very bitter taste of defeat in Vietnam and were determined not to repeat the mistakes they'd made there. The army that went into Iraq in 2003 had won the 91 war, had won in Panama, Kosovo, Bosnia, had sort of won in Haiti, and had a bloodied nose in Somalia, but kind of blamed that on the Clinton administration, and then most recently had won in Afghanistan. They thought of themselves as the best military in the world, and they were for something like fighting the Red Army on the plains of Central Europe. Where they were not very good was in putting down an insurgency, dealing with urban guerrilla warfare and the like. And the problem was there was one other aspect they weren't good at, which is self-examination. The Army has a very good lessons learned process, but it stops at the colonel level. Generals are kind of off-limits to criticism in today's military, and especially in today's Army. And so you had a series of leadership failures that they really didn't confront. For example, not a single general has been relieved in this war. I mean, compare that to World War II, when General George Marshall and the Army Chief of Staff relieved over 100 senior officers at the beginning of the war. Look at Lincoln in the Civil War, constantly fired generals he felt weren't up to the job. But in this war, nobody got relieved, and things like Abu Ghraib were blamed on low-level soldiers. Yes, they did things that were wrong, but I think one of the reasons those things occurred was because of high-level decisions, because the Army was unprepared for the task at hand. So, for example, generals said, let's go out and do big cordon and sweep operations, where they scarfed up tens of thousands of Iraqi males, what they called military-age males, and shipped them off to Abu Ghraib and other facilities, humiliated them in the process, and put them into an unsegregated prison population where average Ahmed, the Iraqi farmer, sat cheek by jowl with al-Qaeda types for 3 months. When those people were released, after 90 days, often without their family being told where they were inclined to be less pro-American generally than when they had gone into prison.
Surprise, surprise.
Why were those lessons ignored? I think it's because of the lack of self-examination inside the military and because you had a Congress asleep at the wheel that wasn't willing to ask the tough questions. The Republicans didn't want to embarrass the Bush administration. The Democrats didn't know how to ask questions, didn't want to get caught on the wrong side, didn't want to seem weak on defense. And when Congress goes silent, it hurts the rest of the government because Congress is the engine of our government. It connects the people to government. And so the war has gone largely unexamined, both for the American people, but also it would help the actual war effort. Here we are, into this war for 4 years. We've been fighting it nearly as long as this nation participated in World War II, yet we've not had a single significant hearing on the conduct of the war, at which, say, division commanders appear. We've had very little congressional oversight of this war. And that's another contrast to American history. During the Civil War, you had an enormously intrusive committee on the conduct of the war that antagonized President Lincoln. During World War II, Harry Truman made his name by holding hearings on defense contracting. So we haven't had hearings. We don't have an activist Congress that wants to ask questions. We don't have a military interested in self-examination. And the real tragedy is there have been some successful commanders on the ground in Iraq. And some special forces guys, yes, but also some conventional commanders. One that I've observed in the field was Major General David Petraeus, commander of the 101st Airborne, who did extremely well in Mosul up in northern Iraq during 2003-04. More recently, I was up in Tal Afar, northwest Iraq, earlier this year with H.R. McMaster, commander of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. And that's worth talking about because here was a unit that in its first tour in Iraq had a mediocre performance. An Iraqi general, for example, who turned himself in, was beaten to death in interrogation. There was an officer in the unit who carried a baseball bat. He called it Iraqi beater, and he used it. McMaster, a very well-educated man who didn't have just to rely on his Army training, took over that unit and turned it around, essentially took a bad football team and turned it into a great soccer team, and really showed the value of leadership. He went to each of his subordinate units, about 3,500 men all told, and looked him in the eye, and he said, every time you disrespect an Iraqi, you are working for the enemy. That's counterinsurgency doctrine encapsulated in a sentence that any 20-year-old soldier can understand.
But it looks like too little too late, though.
It does. McMaster's great lessons up in Tal Afar were not studied by many of his peers. I don't think were even understood by some of his peers. The Army has tried to compensate. They have tried to adjust. But eventually, McMaster's 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment rotated home. Another smaller unit went into Tal Afar. And the last time I looked, there was more violence up there, and it looked like the city might be slipping back into some chaos. It's funny, though. Ambassador Freeman quoted that Einstein comment that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I saw that quote was on a wall in Iraq.
Oh, really?
Where the Army has established a counterinsurgency academy there. And all new commanders coming out to Iraq have to go through this one-week course in counterinsurgency. And that quote is hanging on the wall to remind them that you've got to do things differently. So the Army is trying to adjust, but that too little, too late quote, that's the title of the last chapter in my book, was from an Army Lieutenant Colonel, Joe Rice, who said it to me one day in Baghdad earlier this year.
Well, also, Thomas Ricks, if the Civil War breaks into the open, then the scenarios are pretty bleak. I talked to Ambassador Freeman about Ambassador Peter Galbraith's idea that the United States could retreat into the north of the Kurdish north, but he pointed out it was landlocked, surrounded by hostile neighbors who wouldn't want to cooperate with the United States, including Turkey, an ally. And that, in effect, the only way out is the way in, which is down the main artery down to Kuwait. But that's all Indian country. That's Shia territory.
And so, I was there, yeah. I was in that territory in the spring of 2004 when the Mokhtar Sadr's Mahdi army rose up. And it was quite efficient to the degree that it made me think that Iranian special forces were working with them. I was in a convoy, for example, that was heading down to Najaf. And the bridges in front of us kept on getting dropped. And these were large highway bridges that could take 70-ton tanks. And that's not, you can't just wander along and put a hand grenade there and expect to blow it up. You have to know something about combat engineering to drop a huge highway bridge like that. So it made me think that maybe the Iranians are already helping out down there.
But if we get caught in a three-way shooting match, and essentially have to retreat, where do we go to?
Well, that's a lesser problem. It's a tactical problem. When you have air power, you can pretty much, you know, call your shot in that way. They'd be able to get out, but it would be terribly humiliating and difficult if that were a retreat under fire. The more worrisome problem, I think, is a civil war spilling over the borders of Iraq, which probably would happen very quickly. Turkey, a NATO ally, for example, has said that it would vigorously resist and probably militarily resist an independent Kurdistan. Iran certainly would not stand by if Shia started getting slaughtered in large numbers in the south. But contrarily, I don't think the Sunni Arab world, which is the majority of people in that part of the world, would stand by if the Shia started slaughtering Sunnis. And everybody would be fighting over the oil. So, yeah, it could be an extremely complex fight there that could easily become a regional war. And we might look back at 2006 as actually relatively good days if we start seeing the oil markets disrupted and $10 a gallon for oil here.
Anybody can a handful of guys can stop the flow out of Saudi Arabia.
Well, I think they've tried. They haven't been successful so far. But
in the context of a regional war, it would be inevitable that all supplies in the Gulf of Hormuz would be cut.
Yes, I think it would be very tough to continue normal oil supplies. Mm.
So, just back to without extrapolating on how bad it can get, it seems to be extraordinarily bad at the moment and getting worse. And there is a sort of detachment from reality that you detect in both the president and Rumsfeld. I'm just wondering that, given that Rumsfeld and Cheney had joined at the hip, and many have argued that they've truly been running the show, I get the impression that these guys don't have much of a vision beyond the fact that they're extremely practiced at bureaucratic infighting in Washington. They're absolutely unbeatable in that regard. But you get the impression that they don't have much of a vision beyond getting their way, and that Rumsfeld seems to have been, throughout this whole misadventure, seems to have been motivated by his trying to prove something, that we can do things on the cheap, mean and lean, and you know, damn the results. I mean, I get the impression that he's not dealing with reality here.
Well, they've always seemed to be kind of detached from Iraq, especially Rumsfeld. He seems to act as if it's not his problem. And in some ways, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because Iraq is increasingly becoming a problem for the next American president, not this one. I think we're going to be in Iraq for a long, long time. As I was writing my book, I'd look out the window at 3:30 every day as the young kindergartners were marched from the elementary school near my house to the daycare center on the other side of my house. And I would think in grim moments, one of those kids is going to fight and die in Iraq.
So you, in spite of the trajectory we seem to be on, I mean, where, how can we hold out? I mean, it seems like both the United States and the Israelis now have a kind of Fort Apache approach to the Middle East. I mean,
well, I think the U.S. Two things. First, U.S. military policy, I think, in Iraq is essentially to keep the lid on a civil war. There are worse things than a low-level civil war. One of them is a full-blown civil war. Another is a regional war. So keeping a lid on a civil war may be the honorable and the best course. Just because we went into the country with little forethought and consideration and recklessly doesn't mean we should do the same leaving it. At the same time, when I look at Israel and the United States now in the Middle East, what strikes me is a commonality. Both have inverted the old John Lennon song. All they are saying is give war a chance. In both cases, they decided stability is not their friend, it's their enemy. And that's a reversal of U.S. policy for the last half century in the Middle East. The Bush administration, since 9/11, has targeted stability. It's not their goal. It's what they want to get rid of. And they've achieved that in the short-term tactical sense. The Middle East is a much less stable place than it was on 9/11.
Well, I hope you're right to the extent that we have options, because I'm beginning to think perhaps we don't have any options and that we're not the masters of our own destiny. But I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Thomas Ricks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Hello again, I'm your master. Just speaking there with Thomas Ricks, who's the Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and he's the author of Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kuth, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, and special assistant from Melissa Figueroa.